Hello, everybody. This is Craig from the Pacific War Channel, and I'm joined here today by my friend Justin. How are you?
Not bad, not bad. How's everybody else doing today? And by
Hoping.
everybody else, I mean you.
I was going to say, I'm hoping everybody's good. I myself am tired out of my mind. I have been writing for 2 weeks now a new series I can't really get into, but it involves World War II and it involves North Africa. So I got to thinking, it's actually been quite a long time since I've ever talked about this event, but I happen to have some notes from a very old script I wrote for Kings and Generals on the Battle of Taranto. Now, this is one of the first episodes I ever wrote for them, and it's a very interesting episode. It's an event I don't think a lot of people are even aware of, but it was of critical importance, not just to the war in Europe, but also to the Pacific War. I can imagine, Justin, you've never heard of it.
Well, you see, folks, this is where Craig has once again debated me, because when he told me he wanted to do an episode on the Battle of Toronto, I figured he was just mispronouncing Toronto, Canada.
I knew you were going to come with that.
As he mispronounces everything. And I was like, sure, if there was a fight in Toronto, you know, typical English versus French kids, I'm down. Let's talk about it.
It was 1967.
Yeah. But apparently this is not it. Apparently the British pulled some sneaky sneak on the Italians in the Mediterranean Sea. And yeah, so no, I've obviously never heard of this because obviously we grew up in North America. It's Pearl Harbor or nothing. And yeah, so why don't you fill me in a little bit on what the hell happened?
Hey everyone, I just wanted to let you know I now have a Patreon account found at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel. Over there you can find exclusive Patreon episodes and podcasts based on suggestions from patrons, and other benefits like early access to all of my content, live hangouts, your name in the end credits, and much, much more. So please go check it out. So, for Justin and for the general audience, you're going to want to picture the world. It's 1940. It's the very beginning of World War II for Europe. There's very few players actually involved at this point. So America is not in it. France is just been knocked out. But basically, for those who aren't aware, France, half of France ends up joining the Nazis. So it's Vichy France. And then there is a Free France movement that'll come out later in the war. But they're kind of irrelevant to the story. Now, Britain is currently fighting for their life. Almost single-handedly against, you know, the Nazis. But Britain also is at war with Italy, the lesser partner in the Axis. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, like, well, what exactly is Britain and Italy? What are they going to do in all of this? And you have to picture the Mediterranean Sea. So as anyone knows, the British control the oceans, particularly at the early part of World War II, and they've got multiple fleets. One of their fleets is the Mediterranean Fleet. And it's of I'd say it's critical to the Commonwealth because their fleets are protecting convoys that are going everywhere in the Mediterranean world. So, you know, you have Malta, you have Egypt and such. And they're even transporting things like oil from the Persian oil sands, not to mention the Suez Canal. So that's probably the most important place in World War II as far as the transportation of troops and supplies are concerned. And the British are holding it, but at any moment, the Italians could actually invade Egypt and take it. And later on, even the Germans get involved.
Did the Italians have enough forces to do such a thing? I mean, they were like probably one of the smaller players. I can't see them just like taking over Egypt or Africa by themselves.
Ironically, that is the very episode I am writing currently. I can't really talk about it too much, but the Italians had the manpower. They technically had the number of armor vehicles, but the Italians were very mismanaged, and technologically they had a lot of faults. So not to get too into it because it's not part of the story, but their tank crews didn't have proper radios, and their tanks had less armor, and most of their tanks did not have enough firepower to even penetrate some of the British tanks like the Matilda II.
Okay.
So a handful of Matilda IIs actually end up just taking out hundreds of these poor little Fiat tanks and stuff. And yes, the Fiat company made tanks back then. But
I wonder what the hell happened to them, because there's a lot of things I would call that car, and a tank is not one of them.
It's kind of the same back then. The Fiat tanks were kind of a joke.
Yeah.
You probably hear it all the time. Everyone makes fun of Italy for World War II. You know that they didn't have good infantry, they didn't have good armor. But actually, I don't hear people say much about their air force. I don't think their air force was terrible. But people don't make fun of their navy because their navy was pretty strong at the beginning. They did have a modern navy. They put money into it, and they had threatening battleships. They had quite a few capital ships, actually. And
Okay.
that's kind of the crux of the story. So we play Axis and Allies all the time.
Once or twice we have, yes.
Italy usually starts off with a little navy, and they got like a little, you know,
Little
supply
navy, which
ships.
gets immediately obliterated, yes.
Yeah, but you know, for the most part, it is a big thorn in the Mediterranean. It's like their backyard. That's
Yeah.
basically the crux of the story. While Britain wants to have their convoys move, you know, uninterrupted in the Mediterranean Sea, there happens to be this giant fleet at Taranto. It is very threatening to the British. They run into multiple engagements, and basically, this is where our story is really going to begin. Well,
Okay.
actually, I'd like to start off a little bit earlier because one thing, for people who do know about the Battle of Taranto, they kind of overemphasize an element to it, which is the link between it and Pearl Harbor. And I'll just touch upon that a little bit.
Okay.
So, as you and everybody knows, Pearl Harbor was famously surprise attacked by the Japanese December of 1941. And it was Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto who had performed this.
Yep.
Yamamoto was influenced by a few things in his life to come to the conclusion that he could do such a thing. And,
Heroin.
well, he liked his drink and he liked gambling, but no.
Oh, okay.
Oh, and he also liked his geishas. Really, he really liked geishas.
Already then.
He had a nickname with them, actually. But anyways, there was this novel written really early 20th century by a British journalist, and it was called The Great Pacific War. It theorized an attack against basically the Panama Canal that would cripple the United States, thought to be an attack done by someone like the Japanese. Very prophetic novel. That,
Sounding familiar, yeah.
yeah, it's very interesting that this it was a British military attaché guy who just kind of made up the story, and he went through the lengths of how they would do it, and it involved planes and such. And yeah, it had a real impact on Yamamoto when he read it. It was pretty interesting. So people like to point out that as soon as Yamamoto had read this book, he went back to Japan and he started doing lectures on that specific subject to other people in the Navy. Now, later on, in 1940, November, the HMS Illustrious launches the first aircraft ship-to-ship naval attack in history against the Italian Regia Marina docked in Taranto Harbor.
Okay.
During the attack of what we're going to be speaking about in a bit, Italy loses half of their capital ships in a single night to aerial torpedoes, despite the fact that their ships were in shallow water. So this is identical to what happened at Pearl Harbor. The ships at Pearl Harbor, they believed that they were pretty much safe because the water was so shallow. To their knowledge, torpedoes could not be dropped successfully to hit them because the
Okay.
torpedo would obviously just embed itself into, you know, the what do you call it? The bottom of the ocean, whatever
The
you want to call it,
reef.
the reef, sure. A month after the Battle of Taranto, Admiral Yamamoto, he wrote to his fellow admirals and friends about how he had decided to initiate plans to attack, you know, Pearl Harbor. That'll happen in 1941. A lot of people, they kind of put two and two together, and they think that Taranto inspired Yamamoto to do this. That's not the truth of it. What actually happened was Admiral Yamamoto had already been planning the attack on Pearl Harbor, but a lot of people were against his plans. So every time he would have to basically, like any business meeting, he would pitch this to the army and the other naval staff,
Right.
and they kept putting him down. Basically, the Battle of Taranto, the results proved his concept. So a lot of people changed their mind and then they signed off on the Pearl Harbor attack.
Okay, so this wasn't necessarily the inspiration. This was more the like, see, this can work.
Exactly. Other
Okay.
people, a lot of people also point out that the British and Yamamoto himself, they both faced the challenge of how do you get a torpedo to work in shallow water? Even though the British came up with a special way of doing this, this also did not influence Yamamoto. The method he would choose, he had already figured it out by this time. It's another thing people misconstrue about this.
Anyways. Yeah, but I mean, there's always that discussion about how many, not only medical, but scientific advances were made and artillery advances were made during the war alone.
Mm-hmm. You
know, it catapulted everything like 10 times farther ahead than it ever was. So, you know, obviously they were faced with a problem and they just found a solution to it.
Yeah, actually, technological advances occur tragically in war often. War is kind of like a speeder upper.
Yep, it is.
So during World War II, Britain held multiple Mediterranean territories. Like I mentioned, there's Alexandria in Egypt, you know, Gibraltar, Crete, Malta. These are all refueling points, you know, for their warships and their merchant ships. And a lot of their ships are going between Alexandria and Gibraltar. So these are kind of like the two ends of the Mediterranean, you know?
Yeah.
It's also, they also had bases for submarines because, of course, this is World War II and submarines were very important. So the Italians had pretty decent submarines as well.
Right.
Now, Malta, if you know your geography, it's kind of smack dab in the middle of the Mediterranean and it's really close to Sicily. So it's an unbelievable thorn for Italy because it was a major airbase and the British were just constantly flying aircraft to just screw with everybody around them.
Right.
Now, even before World War II, Britain had devised a plan to attack the port city of Taranto because this is basically one of the largest ports Italy has. And just by definition where it is, if you can imagine Italy in your head, you know, the heel of the boot.
Yeah.
It's inside the heel, basically. It's in a perfect position where no matter what time of day, you can launch your ships and within a few hours, you can probably hit most of the spots in the Mediterranean. Very obnoxious spot.
Not just that, but being in the heel of the boot, if you attack it, aren't they kind of sort of trapped in there?
Well, the port itself is kind of like the same thing. It's a very spherical horseshoe. Yeah, I guess you would call it like a horseshoe that you're going to go into that has defenses. And yeah, it's a beehive for aircraft particularly.
Yeah, but that's also what I'm saying is it seems like a logical place to attack them because they have no escape route. They're completely pinned in there.
Oh, so. Yes. If you were a surface engagement, you would not want to go anywhere near this. You would be dead because shore batteries, for example.
Yeah.
1938, during the Munich crisis, the British commander of the Mediterranean fleet, Admiral Sir Dudley Pound, he was pretty concerned with the survival of the Mediterranean fleet if Italy were to attack. So, you know, he had asked everybody to come up with plans to attack numerous places, of which Taranto was one. You know, these are the just in case we go to war kind of plans.
Right.
Just like how the United States had plans to invade Canada during World War II, by the way. For any contingency.
Yeah, we've talked about that before, yeah.
Yeah, those are the colored plans, they called them. I think Canada was Plan Crimson or something. Yeah.
Oh.
The captain of the HMS Glorious, Lumley Lister, he had advised that Fairy Swordfish, and I want you to picture in your head World War I looking planes, you know, the four-wing planes there, really old looking, the biplane, that Fairy Swordfish biplane torpedo bombers were capable of night attacks. And that's a pretty interesting concept. We'll get into the specs on the plane later.
Okay. Can I just ask you one question before you continue?
Yeah.
Who is it that names these things? Named the ship Glorious and named the plane Fairy Swordfish?
Well, you know, the British, they have the HMS Glorious, the Illustrious, the Invincible, the Indomitable. They have like a theme with
Invincible
them.
And Indomitable for a warship, I get. Glorious and Illustrious?
Oh,
it sounds like a cruise ship, not a fucking...
Yeah, I know. One of my favorite names was the HMS Nemesis. It's an older ship from the Opium War days.
Fantastic name. Amazing, like 9.9 out of 10.
Every Navy has... Every Navy had
Glorious gets like a negative 2.
Every Navy had a special way of naming their ships. So, for example, for the Imperial Japanese Navy, they named them after, well, it depends on what type of ship, but they could be named after mountains in Japan or other geographical locations. Like, it depended. If it was a cruiser, it was like a certain thing. If it was a battleship, it was a certain thing. And
okay,
every
but
country.
But named after a town, named after a general, name something that's sounds a little ominous or something. Okay, fine. But Glorious, Majestic, Princess, Sparkles, fucking How much fear are you putting into your enemies with a warship named that? I mean, come on.
I know.
Okay, anyway, so back to that and the unicorn planes.
Yeah, please, the unicorn planes. So, you know, hearing that they were capable of a night attack, which is very, very new to anybody. Like, you do not, back in these days, you do not want to do anything at night with aircraft until radar got better. So this is pretty revolutionary stuff.
Okay.
So it's 1940. Both nations, their supply lines, you know, are in complete chaos because there's something else going on called the North African campaign. Basically, right. If you know where Libya is and Egypt, they're basically fighting around there at this time.
Yeah.
So their supply convoys are having this ordeal of either going through the Mediterranean, in which they're under the threat of the other guy's fleet, or they could technically go all the way around Africa, but you can imagine that's an incredible amount of fuel consumption. That's a lot of lost time. That's no good. Not for
that's
war.
Why the Mediterranean has always been so hard fought for.
Exactly.
Because if you want access to the inland or east, it's a direct shot rather than going all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, for people who are paying attention nowadays to certain conflicts and disagreements between, for example, Greece and Turkey, or you know, there's reasons for this, and a lot of them have to do with exactly that. It's not just about oil, although a lot of it is. It's a hub. It's a hub to like everything, both European, Asian, and African. So both. How do you say both for three different things?
All together. I have no idea.
Okay, English lesson next. All right, yeah. But it's a main hub, and that's why to this day there's still conflicts and little squabbles going on around it. So,
and basically, Italy is employing a strategy that came about in the late 19th century. It's called the fleet and being concept. It's pretty simple. You keep a bunch of your biggest, baddest warships in a harbor, and you just threaten people. So you don't leave your harbor, because if your ships are at harbor, usually they're under the best possible protection imaginable. Like, you have shore batteries, anti-aircraft guns and such. And since Taranto is basically in a position where it can go anywhere in the Mediterranean, that meant the British could do little to nothing about it.
So they basically just have their bazooka on the table and they're like, yeah, good luck coming at us.
Yeah, so if Britain wants to move anywhere in the Mediterranean, they have to make sure that that's a pretty big fleet, because at any moment, the Italians could just bum rush them with this enormous fleet of capital ships.
Okay.
It's pretty scary. And this is
kind of ironic, though, that this was meant as a show of power to say, like, yeah, this is here and you can't do anything about it. And then the British just walked in and did something about it.
Exactly. And if you think about
ballsy.
It, it's a very cost effective strategy, because you have your entire fleet. You don't want to risk your fleet, by the way. That's kind of a big point of this. These are capital battleships. They're very expensive. So you leave them at port and they're basically doing the work that they need to do, because you don't need to destroy the enemy. You just need the enemy not to destroy any of your stuff. So they're doing their job. And everything is going very well for Italy at the beginning here. It's going to go terrible later.
Yep. And, doesn't sound like they had a great day, but
I mean, everywhere Italy went, it just went terribly. I can only think of, there was a special forces in Italy, the Italian forces that fought in Stalingrad. It's the only thing I know the Italians did very well, because everywhere was just a disaster.
There's probably a whole bunch of Italians raging at you right now, but
it is what it is when it comes to World War II. I mean, like, there's... Oh, God, I've been writing for 2 weeks just about the Italians just fleeing in North Africa. It's kind of it's comical. Even this episode is going to be a bit comical. World War II was not good for Italy, I'll say that much.
Well, now, they did lose, so, yep.
So you imagine Britain's facing this problem in the Mediterranean Sea, and then France falls. It's a pretty big shock. So that means their ally in the Mediterranean, the French, you know, over in Marseille and stuff, now they're gone. So this is a huge issue. Now, it becomes an even worse issue when half of the French government literally joins the enemy. So Britain, you know, they feel they can't allow these French warships, which were very strong warships, by the way. The French had a decent navy in World War II. They can't let these French warships simply go over to the Germans. So the first thing the British do is they need to neutralize them. This prompted the Royal Navy to perform Operation Catapult. This occurs on July the 3rd of 1940. It was a naval attack against the French ships at the naval base of Mers El Kébir. I'm sorry, I probably misspelled that. That's Adoran in French Algeria. What's significant about this is the British carrier HMS Hermes deployed 6 Swordfish torpedo bombers. So it's going to be the same ones we're talking about, but later.
Okay.
Of Squadron 814. And they hit the French battleship Richelieu on her starboard side, tearing a hole in her. It's about 31 by 38 feet. They break her propeller shafts. They severely damage her. If anyone plays World of Warships, it's a beautiful battleship, by the way. And tragic that she got taken down like this for a while. The British pilots, they ended up getting a lot of valuable experience because, you know, this is the first time, like, basically, they got to really hit a capital ship with torpedoes.
Right.
Not to mention, it's going to be the same aircraft we're going to be talking about. Just months before Operation Judgment. And that's going to be the Battle of Toronto.
Okay.
So, Operation Judgment is scheduled for October the 21st, 1940. It's Trafalgar Day. And the task is going to be given to Commander Rear Admiral Leister. And he's going to be given carriers HMS Illustrious, which I know you love that name, two heavy cruisers, the HMS Berwick and York, light cruisers, the Gloucester, the Glasgow, destroyers, the Hyperion, Ilex, the Hastie, and the Havelock. Hope I didn't mispronounce any of those, because everyone gives me shit all the time. I mispronounce boats and stuff. I do apologize to the for the early days. A few years ago, I mispronounced quite a few ships. People keep telling me. It is what it is.
Yep.
Now, they're going to have over 21 swordfish to deploy. These are going to be from squadrons 806, 813, 815, 819, and 824. Now, about the ship... about the aircraft in question. Like I said, it's a biplane, so if you're trying to imagine in your head, it's a old-looking World War One plane.
Yep.
And they were introduced in 1936. It's probably going to raise some eyebrows that a biplane in 1936 is going on, but it's kind of like, the way I would describe it, when everybody started to make, you know, monoplanes, so that's two-wing aircraft,
yeah.
No one knew yet how to make perfect ones. So there were companies that were just trying to stick to what they knew to perfect it.
Right.
So the Swordfish is kind of like the best of the biplanes. I'll call it like that.
Okay.
Stating that, it was a slow son of a bitch. This was a very slow aircraft. And it would take very long to approach a warship and to launch a torpedo. But it did have a unique perk. Kind of because of the fact it was so heavy and slow, it could operate at night because it was a very sturdy aircraft and it was capable of carrying an extremely large load. They were going to be fastened with these 18-inch torpedoes that were like about 1,500 pounds.
Right.
So it's a heavy load. And one of their strengths was because of how slow they were, they basically could maneuver in just about any weather condition. Nothing really hit them too hard. So they were pretty reliable. And they were very easy to fly. So basically all of this is just to say, you could probably reliably fly these at night. So half of the Swordfish in this mission, they're going to be armed with these torpedoes. The other half are going to have 250-pound just aerial bombs and flares. These are going to be for diversionary attacks. The torpedoes are going to be fitted with a duplex pistol device that uses a magnetic contact exploder. What this means is, when the torpedo goes underneath one of these very large battleships, it'll the magnet will like feel the metal density and it'll explode. Now, about the shallow water issue, this is kind of the crux of what the British had to figure out. What the British ended up doing is they attached wire to each of the torpedo's noses so that when it fell into the water, it produced a belly flop instead of just like going directly through and going very deep into the water. This allowed them to drop to about a rate of 22 feet. Pretty impressive. For those who already know their history, the way the Japanese got away with Pearl Harbor is they attached these wooden fins to their torpedoes that allowed them to do something quite similar. So two completely different techniques, but kind of the same results.
Yeah, but my question is still how... Okay, they figured out the torpedo problem, but you say all these warships are pinned into a harbor with crazy defenses, anti-aircraft, all this stuff. So how does the British sneak in with what you're telling me is like the slowest, clunkiest, easy to hit airplane and not just get annihilated in the process?
Yeah, we're going to get into it soon. I'll talk about the Italian defenses.
Okay. And
just so you're aware, the Italians weren't aware of some of the technological advances the British had done. For example, the magnetic pistol. So the thing that allows the torpedoes to explode underneath ships, the Italians did not know this existed. So just keep that in mind. If the Italians think that a torpedo can only come straight, you know, at the side of the hull, then something like a torpedo net will protect the ship. But they didn't know about other things. Yeah. So these torpedo-equipped planes, they're going to be guided by moonlight to hit these battleships, which I got to say, that must have been pretty intense because you really got to imagine there wasn't much lighting. It's not like they're going to, you know, just show where they are. And the attack was going to consist of two waves. One was going to come in from the west towards the rising moon and another from the north. Both waves would have aircraft shooting flares over the battleships to illuminate them. So, you know, to make things even more dangerous for these pilots, they got to throw flares over the battleships first, and then the other torpedo guys are going to have to come in. So you're already
which is a big giant, hey, guess what? We're here. Good luck.
Oh, yeah. Now, to protect the torpedo planes, they decided they were going to do some distractions. So they were going to try and, you know, keep the searchlights directed upward, not directly on the torpedo plane. So all the other guys who don't have torpedoes, they're basically just kind of, they're the diversions, you know. Some of the dive bomber swordfish would actually, they'd attack the dockyards and other of the smaller ships in Mount Piccolo.
Can you imagine being one of those? Not necessarily a kamikaze pilot, but just, okay, so you're going to go and distract the enemy and they're all going to try and shoot you down so that they hopefully don't shoot down the other guy. Well, no, I want to be the other guy.
Oh, yeah.
Let somebody else do this job. Just, oh, my God. Okay.
No, like, it goes without saying, this was a very ballsy operation.
Oh, this sounds like a suicide mission and a half. I'm not going to lie.
A lot of the guys who were performing this did believe it was a suicidal mission. No one knew that there was even a chance of success. Like, it was a big gamble.
I guess maybe that's part of the reason why it succeeded is they figured, okay, nobody would be crazy enough to do this. So we'd... I don't know how prepared the Italians were for it, but, you know, if they kind of figured, yeah, there's no way somebody's going to walk in our front door and do this, very much like the U.S. with Pearl Harbor, then part of the reason why it's so successful.
The thing about this is it had never been done before, an attack by air like this, like a mass raid on the ships at port. It had been done with surface ships. So the Japanese in the Russo-Japanese War, they attacked Port Arthur using destroyers. So they came in real close to the docks in the middle of the night before declaring war, mind you. And then they just launched a bunch of torpedoes at the Russian battleships. So you can imagine, perhaps the Italians thought something like that would happen. But it might have been a little bit inconceivable that, you know, a cluster of aircraft carrier aircraft would attack them. They might have not even considered it.
Okay, now help me out with one thing here. Because, you know, you and I have both played some World of Warships, but what is the approximate effective range of a torpedo? Like, how close does one ship have to be to another ship in World War II times to actually start launching torpedoes and possibly hit something?
Some of the shittiest torpedoes could have been 4 kilometers. The Japanese had long range, so the long lance torpedoes that could go something like 20 almost. But that was the extreme. If you're looking for something in between, so let's say about 10. But it's not every single kilometer you're adding onto that, it's ineffective. You want to get as close as possible.
No, I understand that, but that's still another thing. Whether somebody's declared war or not, how do you have like an entire fleet of warships showing up where your entire fleet of warships is and not just go like, huh, I wonder what they're here for.
Oh, they had no idea. It was the middle of the night. They hadn't declared war yet. And the destroyers snuck in for the attack on Port Arthur. And they volleyed all these torpedoes. The torpedoes actually weren't that effective, to be honest. There was a lot of duds and issues. But yeah, no, they were taken by surprise. It was kind of the Russians were partying that night, actually, too, ironically. So there was other things going on.
Yeah, I don't know.
But
seems like somebody wasn't doing their job. You know, the lookout guy on the Titanic didn't see the fucking iceberg. This is the feeling I'm getting. But all right, so back to Tirana.
So the RAF, they made several reconnaissance flights using Martin Marylands to just see that the Regia Marina was actually even in Taranto at the time. And, you know, to scout out the defenses. So the port of Taranto had 101 anti-aircraft guns, 193 machine guns, and 90 low-flying barrage balloons. Those are actually going to be the most annoying thing for these aircraft. Unfortunately for the Italians, around this time, there was a really big storm, and it kind of took away most of the balloons, at least like 30 of them. The fleet in Taranto consisted of 6 battleships. Those are their capital ships, 9 heavy cruisers, 7 light cruisers, and 13 destroyers. Now, the main defenses for these ships in the harbor, that's anti-torpedo nets. Unfortunately, Italy only had a few of them on hand at the time. They were building more, so that didn't go their way. They needed something like almost 13,000 meters of netting. They only had like about 4,000 at the time. So not all the ships were covered properly. The netting was designed to protect against torpedoes armed with contact pistols. Now, as I keep saying, the British are using a magnetic pistol. So it doesn't just have to like ram into the hull of the ship. It could trail underneath, go around, anywhere near. As long as it feels the metal, it'll explode. Okay. So the Italians, they're only thinking about protecting the sides of their battleships and at a specific depth, you know, because that's where their hulls are.
Right.
Because of this, the torpedoes that could pass beneath the ship are going to basically destroy it, and the Italians have no means to protect from this. And the British knew this, so they calculated that they would do these runs of about 27 knots, set their torpedoes to go at about 33 feet, hoping to go just underneath the nets and to go underneath the ship and blow up, which they would. Operation Judgment was also part of a larger operation, MB8, requiring multiple naval forces to coordinate. The rationale for this kind of complex operation, involving a lot of convoys and stuff going on that we won't talk too much about, and other task forces, was to simply confuse the Italians as to what was going on, you know, to make sure that they don't realize, oh, wow, they're about to attack Taranto. So they had to get surprised, just like the attack on Pearl Harbor and the attack on Port Arthur that I mentioned. Everything was about surprise in this attack.
Okay.
The HMS Illustrious left port November the 6th. She had her escorts with her. And they publicly announced that they were departing and heading for Malta, which would not be unusual. The fact that they said this publicly is kind of interesting because, you know, all of these enemies are listening to each other's radio traffic and all that.
Right.
So on November the 10th, the Illustrious secretly detaches from her convoy. Super dangerous thing to do, by the way. And she heads northeast in the direction of Taranto. Now, the original date to do this was supposed to be on October the 21st, but some things had gone wrong. There had been a fire on the HMS Illustrious. Some aircrafts ran into each other and stuff. So that's why we are seeing this happen in November instead. They also had to wait for another day that had enough moonlight. So they had to wait for a moon cycle. On the night of November the 11th, the 21 Swordfish began to launch in two waves. The first one consisted of 12 Swordfish at 8:40 p.m. and the second was 9 at 9:34 p.m. 6 aircraft in the first wave, and then 4 in the second wave, they were carrying 250-pound aerial bombs and flares. At 4 minutes to about 11 o'clock at night, the first wave splits into 2 sections with 3 bombers and 1 torpedo bomber each. And they're straying away from the main force. The smaller force, they're going to continue to Toronto, while the main force is going to approach the harbor at Mar Grande at about almost 11. Sorry. Over 16 flares are dropped on the East Harbor by Lieutenant Kigle and Lieutenant Lamb while they're bombing the oil depots, setting them ablaze. Also probably illuminating the entire area. You can imagine these huge oil tanks being bombed. It's going to be a big fire.
Yeah, fair point.
The next 3 torpedo bombers, led by Lieutenant Commander Kit Williamson of the 815 Squadron. They flow over the Fulmine and Lampo, and they're going to launch torpedo. And they strike the battleship Conte de Cavour. They blast a 27-foot hole in her side below the waterline. This is a capital ship. This is a huge thing ahead.
Yep. As Williams... That's a big hole to patch.
Oh, yes. As Williamson tries to pull away from this big ship, he's shot down by her anti-aircraft guns, unfortunately. Williamson, his co-pilot, Lieutenant Scarlett, they survive. They crash into the water in the harbor, but they are going to be taken prisoner. Now, there are two other planes with them. They dodge this whole thing with the barrage balloons and the anti-aircraft gunfire, and then they are going through kind of the gauntlet. There's even shore batteries shooting at them.
Right.
They're trying to hit another battleship, the Andrea Doria. They miss it, and their aircraft basically try to come around to hit another battleship. This is probably the most important one of the fleet, the Littori. They launch torpedoes, and they hit her on her starboard bow and on the port quarter, basically like, I think you call it a hammer and an anvil attack. So they're attacking from both sides when they hit her. And they send her right into the mud, so she's sinking down quick. Took on a lot of water. Mind you, this is a shallow port, so it's not like she's under the water or anything, but still.
Yeah, but still, sunk is sunk. I mean, can't do anything.
Mm-hmm. Now, the bomber force, led by Captain O'Patch, they try to attack two cruisers moored at Mar Piccolo. So there's two, to describe kind of the layout, there's basically two harbors. One's in the north and one's in the south. This one's in the north. It's a lot harder to get to, and there's a lot more defense.
What's it called, this other port?
Mar Piccolo. I know you're going to say something.
No, I'm just looking for it on the map.
I thought you were going to make like a Piccolo joke and only Dragon no. Balls. Yeah, unless I'm probably saying that wrong. I'm assuming it's Mar Piccolo. If I said that wrong, I'm sorry, Italian audience.
Okay, anyway.
And they managed to, they hit a ship with just a single bomb. Doesn't do too much damage, mind you. And it's just after 11 p.m. And Lieutenant Murray, he attempts to dive bomb the destroyer, the Libizio, and his bombs fail to detonate. So basically, the duds just hit the ship. Lieutenant Sara, he tries to do the same thing, but he doesn't manage to hit anything. So he instead opts to hit a seaplane base. Now, that was it for the first wave. The second wave of eight aircraft, they're coming in. And Lieutenant Clifford accidentally collides with another aircraft while they're launching off the aircraft carrier. So he's not out of it. He manages to repair his aircraft, but basically he launches 25 minutes after everybody else. But he still goes on a solo run, which is takes hella balls to do that.
Yep.
I mean, he's coming after everything's said and done. So when everybody's awake, you know?
Yeah. What's that movie again? Slapping the Bull? It'll be interesting to see what the bull does now that he's alert.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the second wave, they approach from the north. So they're actually hooking all the way around to hit them from the north to try and, you know, surprise the enemy again. And they're going to go towards the Mar Grande Harbor. Lieutenant Hamilton, Lieutenant Skelton, they drop flares just around midnight. And they head towards the oil storage depots to just keep bombing the shit out of those again. Because it's never a bad thing to get rid of the enemy's oil, especially the Italians and the Germans, who have very little of it.
Okay.
Lieutenant Hale, he comes from the north, and he lines up with the battleship Littori. Again, this poor ship. And alongside him is Lieutenant Torrin Spence and Lieutenant Bailey. And they all approach, and fortunately, Lieutenant Bailey is shot down by the heavy cruiser Gorizia. Her anti-aircraft guns get him. Both him and his co-pilot, they are killed. As for Lieutenant Hale and Lieutenant Torrin Spence, they both launch torpedoes at the Littorio, and one successfully hits her on the stern, so making her life even more miserable. Despite taking a lot of anti-aircraft fire, both aircrafts actually managed to pull out. Very surprising, because you have to imagine there's like hundreds of guns shooting these things. Very slow airplanes.
Right.
Behind them comes Lieutenant Lee, and he launches a torpedo at the Cayo Durio. And he hits her on her starboard side, blowing a hole in her hull and flooding her forward magazines. The final aircraft of the second wave, flown by Lieutenant Wellham, coming over the town of Toronto itself, he approaches the flagship Vittorio Veneto, and he launches a torpedo, but he misses. His aircraft is also heavily damaged by anti-aircraft fire, but he does manage to limp away. Now, that guy I mentioned who damaged his aircraft 15 minutes after everybody else, I mean, this guy probably was flying as fast as he possibly could, he shows up to the scene completely alone. He attempts to dive bomb an Italian cruiser, the Trento, and he faces the complete undivided attention of every single anti-aircraft gun. He drops his bombs. He seems to make a single hit on the Trento, but it doesn't detonate, so it's another dud. Somehow this guy gets out of there, and I mean, every gun probably was shooting this guy. He probably couldn't see anything but explosions all around him. Now, the aftermath of everything all said and done, the British, they lost two aircraft. Two crew members were taken prisoner, the other two were killed. As for the Italian Regia Marina, they suffered an unbelievable amount of losses if you think about it. The battleship Conte di Cavour, she's got a 39 by 26 foot hole in her hull. 27 of her crew were killed, 100 were wounded in the bomb blast. She's at the bottom of the shallow water. Her superstructure and main armaments are remaining above water, but she's never going to see full service again. Basically, they try to repair her, but they never end up finishing it during World War II. That's probably pretty frustrating, I'd say. The battleship Caio Duilio, she has a 36 by 23 by 23 foot hull. And she's saved, so her repair crews managed to save her before she literally runs aground. The battleship Littorio, she's been hit by three torpedoes. She has considerable flooding. Her ship's bows were totally submerged, and by the next morning, 32 of her crew are dead, many are wounded. She's sitting at the bottom, too. The heavy cruiser Trento was damaged by an unexploded bomb, tore a hole in one of her fuel tanks, and took, you know, a few months to repair. Nothing too big, though. The destroyers Libisio and the Bisagano, they're both hit by duds again like the other one, and they just require, you know, a few months to repair. It would take 4 months to repair Littorio, 7 months for the Duilio, and the Conte di Cavour would never get repaired. So it was a lot of damage was done during this attack. Two Italian aircrafts were also destroyed on the ground. The seaplane hangars were destroyed, the oil depots were lit on fire, harbor was severely damaged, and an estimated 15,000 rounds from the shore batteries and the anti-aircraft guns, all that stuff, you know, what you shoot up, it must come down.
Right.
A lot of it fell on the city of Toronto.
Okay.
Yeah. Basically fucked up their own city in a lot of ways. But stating that, the Italian Navy, they lost half of their capital ships in a single night. The next day, the Regia Marina, they were forced to transfer all of their undamaged warships from Taranto to Naples. And yeah, basically the threat of Taranto was neutralized for quite a long time. And the balance of power shift to the British completely. They basically control the Mediterranean.
Wow.
And yeah, that that was a very interesting thing for everybody who paid attention. The Japanese were very interested. So like I kept saying, Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, as soon as he heard about this event, he ordered a lieutenant commander, Takeshi Natsuo, to go investigate the incident. So the guy showed up, he spoke with the Italians, and he learned about what the British had done. After this, he reported back to Yamamoto, and Yamamoto would speak to Commander Fusio Fuchida. He's going to be one of the guys who leads the first wave during the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Right.
So it was definitely put into the mindset of these people, but I will state again, all the people I mentioned were already working on the attacks for Pearl Harbor. So it was just kind of supporting what they were already planning, more or less.
Yeah. I mean, seems like a lot of these forces in World War II were just not prepared to be attacked. I don't know.
It was a lot of not thinking about things. If you think about the attack on, let's say, on Pearl Harbor, it's more egregious because they had this to look at. You know, just a year ago, the British had done this to Italy, and the Americans kind of, I mean, some Americans understood the potential for an aircraft carrier to just randomly come over and attack a port. But what the Americans kind of lacked to think about is, would the Japanese send the entire Kido Butai with hundreds of aircraft in waves to attack Pearl Harbor? That was something I don't think they foresaw.
And yeah, I mean, fair enough, but Jesus Christ, it's a ship in World War II. It just floats at you. How do you not see it coming?
Yeah, but the navies were very important during the war. I mean, if you look at it from the British point of view, the only reason why Britain even survived the war and could be was because of their navy. The Germans controlled a lot of the air during the Battle of Britain. But the one thing that they couldn't do is they couldn't land troops in Britain. Because as many transport aircraft as you possibly have, there's no way to use them to drop men and supplies that could take over Britain. You would need a surface fleet, you know, to move everything.
Right.
And it was impossible. The British Navy. The Germans put all their chips into submarines because there was no way they would have the resources to make, you know, such a formidable fleet to just overwhelm the British, who had been sitting on the best fleet for 20 years or so. The Italians, likewise, they put a shit ton of money into their fleet. And, well, it didn't really pay off for them because they didn't use it well.
Now, obviously, this attack wasn't the end of Italy because it happened in 1940 and the war went on for quite a bit after that.
No, the Italians will have a naval success a few months after this against the British in an engagement. They're definitely not over. It's not over, but the fear...
Well, I mean, America wasn't over after Pearl Harbor either, but...
Well, exactly. But that's just it. The fear that you can be attacked now in your port this way, it definitely struck a chord for the Italians. Well, everybody kind of learned a lesson in a lot of ways. People protected their ships a bit better.
Yeah.
But this rather ballsy move by the British, you know, it's funny. You often don't hear about it too much when people talk about World War II. And it's fascinating how it kind of... You know, like you said, it's almost like it's a prelude to Pearl Harbor. It's the blueprints.
Right. But it seems to me, too, like, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm anything but a naval strategist or anything. It's, I understand this thought by the Italians of just kind of sit in the middle of the bowl and whatever happens anywhere, we can get there kind of quick. But it seems to me if you're kind of the main fleet that's controlling the Mediterranean, the main thing to control would be the access points, because if somebody wants to come at you, well, there's only one or two of them. You block that, nobody's getting in to fuck with you. You know, good old 300, you know?
Yeah, and here, so, I'll prove a point more about the importance of something like this. The British and the Italians, at the beginning, they're going to fight something called the North African Campaign. So if you picture North Africa right now, picture the Italians are on the left of North Africa and the British are in Egypt on the right.
Yeah.
The Italians, as soon as France fell, basically their enemy to the left of them, so in Algeria, was neutralized. This was technically their ally, but actually it's going to turn out that the Free French are going to own that territory. It will become an enemy later on, but... For the sake of this, in 1940, they were neutralized and they were only looking at the British to the right. The British were sitting on the Suez Canal. And this was probably one of the most important things. Like, this is, whoever controls this, it might win the war for you. And the Italians knew if they took it, it's like from there, they can grab the Persian oil fields. They are disrupting all of British commerce, trade, their troop transport. They could effectively take Britain out of the war. And they're going to attack Egypt. Unfortunately, the British hit them first. So even like this, the Battle of Taranto, the British perform some raids. The Italians throw an invasion force. And it is a catastrophe, despite the fact they outnumber the British like 5-1. Okay. And the British beat them so badly that they basically chase them all the way to the other side of North Africa. And Mussolini is forced to beg Hitler to bring German forces. So the famous Commander Rommel, he's going to bring the Africa Corps, as it's known in English, over to fight the war on the Italians' behalf. At the same time, I just kind of love to make fun of Italy for a second. When Mussolini had his commanders in North Africa start this Italian invasion of Egypt, without telling anybody, he invaded Greece. And all of the supplies that were going to be used for the North African campaign went to Greece, without those commanders in North Africa knowing. So Mussolini was kind of an idiot. And the Italians lost the battle against Greece, and they would have to call for the Germans to help them again. So yeah, the Italians made a lot of mistakes in World War II.
I mean, I can say this from the times I've played Axis and Allies, it pretty much is just sitting there with Italy waiting for Germany to help.
But one thing that the Italians could have done, even though they were losing on the land, let's say, the Germans, when they come to North Africa, they are wrecking everybody. It is insane. And their armored tanks are unbelievably formidable. Like, the British almost don't have an answer to some of these tanks. Problem is, because the sea lanes weren't controlled, because the Germans didn't have enough naval forces and the Italians were too afraid to do anything, the British basically were just using their navy and their air power to hit the Germans and Italians everywhere they were in North Africa for the entire campaign. Nothing the Germans and Italians could really do. And anytime they would try to send troop ships or even ships with oil, mind you, the British would just take them out.
Hmm.
And Taranto is a big part of that. It's the Italians, they got cold feet after that, and they just couldn't hold the fort down.
Right.
But that, I think that states pretty much everything. But as I did not say this at the beginning of the episode, for everybody listening here on Spotify, Podbean, Apple, iTunes, wherever you listen to your podcast, I want you to know that I also have a Patreon account at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel. And over there, I have exclusive podcasts, one each month. We're about, I think, 16 or 17 episodes plus at this point. To give an idea, the last episode I did was a two-parter on the wacky Battle of Castle Itter. But I've done tons of episodes. It's not only on the Pacific War. I touch on just about any history that the audience is interested in. And if you become a patron, you can vote on the next subject. You get to do live hangouts with me. You get, of course, the exclusive podcasts. Me and Justin sometimes play video games live. It's kind of like a Q&A thing that we do.
Yeah.
And yeah, there's also other goodies. So please, if you'd like to support the channel, go check it out. For as little as $2, you get quite a lot, I'd say. I try to really give more than the other guys are giving right now at the History Patreon accounts. But yeah, just want to say a big thanks to Justin for being the hostage today.
Yeah, always a pleasure. I mean, learn something new every day. But next time you say we're talking about Toronto, we're doing the real Toronto, okay? This is, I feel jebaited.
Oh boy, it would be funny to do like a, what would you say is the most historic hockey game? The Soviet Union versus the Canadians? That bloody match? That one everyone talks about. I don't know.
Historic, yeah, probably. That's probably a big one, the gold medal game.
But this has been the Pacific War Channel. Over and out.
Thanks, guys.